office thing going on, with her laptop and a little printer and files spread out on the counter in the back. The laptop was open to WebMD, and she was busily taking notes when I came in. "Who ordered the Penang curry and pad thai?" I called from the doorway.
"That would be me," Bree said.
She picked her way past all the equipment and gave me a kiss hello. "How's our girl been doing?" I asked.
"Still fighting. She's amazing. She really is."
Nana looked a little more peaceful, maybe, but otherwise seemed about the same. Dr. Engelfield had already warned us not to get too invested in the minutiae. You could drive yourself crazy scrutinizing every little tick and twitch when the important thing was to keep showing up and never lose hope. While I unpacked the food, Bree caught me up on the day. Engelfield wanted to keep Nana on beta blockers for the time being. Her heart was still weak, but it was steady for what that was worth. And they were going to take the dialysis down to 3 times a day.
"There's a new resident, Dr. Abington, you should talk to about that," Bree said. "I've got her number right here."
I traded a plate of food and a bottle of water for it.
"You're doing too much," I told Bree.
"This is the closest thing I've ever had to a real family," she said. "You know that, don't you?"
I did. Bree's mother died when she was 5, and her father never expressed much interest in his children after that. She'd been raised by a series of cousins more than anything, and when she left home at 17, she never looked back. "All the same," I told her, "you can't take off from work indefinitely."
"Sweetie, listen to me. I hate that this is happening. There's nothing good about it. But as long as this is the deal, then I am right where I want to be. End of story, okay? I'm fine with it."
She twirled up a forkful of rice noodles and popped them into her mouth, with a grin I hadn't seen in a while.
"Besides, what are they going to do at work? Replace me? I'm too good for that."
I couldn't argue there.
"Honestly, I'm not sure I could have done everything Bree was doing. Maybe I'm not that generous. But I do know that she made me feel lucky and incredibly grateful.
There was never going to be enough I could do to thank her for this, but Bree didn't seem to want any payback." We spent the rest of the evening with Nana, reading out loud from Another Country, an old favorite of hers. Then around 10 o'clock, we kissed her goodnight, and for the first time since this had happened, I went home to sleep in my own bed, right next to Bree, where I belonged. Chapter 68. When Ned Mahoney called me the next day and said I should meet him at the Hirschhorn Sculpture Garden, I didn't question it for a single moment. I left the office right away and marched over there.
The beat goes on, in double time. Now what does Ned want? What has he found out?
He was waiting on one of the low cement walls when I came down the ramp from the mall side. Before I even reached him, he was up and walking, and when I did come alongside, he started briefing me without so much as a hello. I knew Ned well enough to understand when I should just shut up and listen. Apparently, the Bureau had already secured an administrative subpoena to get a look at Tony Nicholson's overseas bank records. They'd gotten a whole list of deposits, originating accounts, and names attached to those accounts through something called the SWIFT program. SWIFT stood for the Society of Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications. It's a global cooperative based in Belgium that tracks something on the order of 6 trillion transactions every day. The database doesn't include routine banking. They don't necessarily know when I go to the ATM, but just about everything else is in there. The program was under all kinds of legal scrutiny, since it had come out that the U.S. government was using it to track terror cells post 9/11. Whatever the obstacles, though, someone at the Bureau had gotten around them.
"If this were my case, which it isn't, I'd follow the numbers," Mahoney said, still peppering me with information. "I would start with the biggest depositors into Nicholson's account and work my way down from there. I don't know how much time you'll have, though, Alex. This thing is unbelievably hot. Something is not right here, in a big way."
Isn't the Bureau already on it? They have to be, right? It was the first question I'd asked in 5 minutes of nonstop talk. Ned was as manic as I'd ever seen him, which is saying a lot, since he's usually a buzzsaw on Red Bull. Honestly, I don't know, he said with a shrug. He shoved his hands into his pockets, and we started another lap around the sunken garden. Something's sure up, Alex. Here's an example. I don't understand it, but the whole case has been moved out to the Charlottesville Resident Agency, which is a satellite. They'll work with Richmond, I guess. Moved? That doesn't make any sense. Why would they do that? I knew from past experience that the Bureau didn't swap cases around midstream on a whim. It almost never happened. They might cobble a task force between offices to cover a wider area, but nothing like this. Word came down from the deputy director's office yesterday, and they transferred the files overnight. I don't know who the new SAC is, or if there even is one. Nobody'll talk to me about this case. As far as they're all concerned, I'm just a guy running a lot of field agents. I shouldn't even be on this anymore. I definitely shouldn't be here.
Maybe they're trying to tell you something, I said. But he ignored the joke. It was pretty lame anyway. I just wanted to calm Ned down a little if I could. I wanted him to speak slowly enough that I could follow.
He stopped by the big Rodin in the garden, took my hand, and shook it in an oddly formal way. I've got to go, he said.
Mahoney, you're freaking me out a little here.
See what you can get done. I'll find out what I can, but don't depend on the Bureau in the meantime. For anything. Do you understand?
No, Ned, I don't. What about this bank list you were just talking about?
He was already walking away, up the stone stairs toward Jefferson Drive.
Don't know what you mean, he said over his shoulder, but he was patting his coat pocket when he said it.
I waited for him to leave, then checked my pocket. There, along with my keys, was a black and silver thumb drive.
Chapter 69. Ned could lose more than his job for handing over the kind of sensitive information he'd just given me. He could go to jail, too. I owed it to him to do as much with the list as I could. So I took his advice and started right at the top, with Tony Nicholson's biggest single benefactor. If someone had told me a month ago that Senator Marshall Yarrow of Virginia had a connection to a scandal like this, I would have been highly skeptical. The man had too much to lose, and I don't mean just money, though he had plenty of that, too. Yarrow was a billionaire before he was 50, riding the dot-com wave in the 90s and then getting out. He'd turned part of his fortune into a Bill Gates-style foundation run by his wife, focused on children's health initiatives in the United States, Africa, and East Asia. Then he leveraged all that goodwill and another big pile of money into a Senate campaign that no one took too seriously until he won. Now Yarrow was in his second term, and it was an open secret in Washington that he'd already formed an off-the-books exploratory committee with his eye on the next presidential election. So yes, plenty to lose, but he wouldn't be the first Washington politician to blow it all on hubris, would he? With a little calling around, I found out that Yarrow had a working lunch in his office that day, followed by a 1:30 TVA caucus meeting, both in the Russell Senate office building. That would put him in the Southwest lobby just before 1:30. And that's when and where I went after him. At 1:25, he came off the elevator with a retinue of power-suited aides, all of them talking at once. Yarrow himself was on the phone. I stepped into his line of sight with my badge out.
Excuse me, Senator. I was hoping for a minute of your time.
The one woman in the group of aides, strikingly blonde, attractive, late 20s, stepped between us.
Can I help you, officer?
It's detective, I told her, but kept my eyes on Yarrow, who had at least put a hand over his trio.
Just a few questions for Senator Yarrow. I'm investigating a large credit card fraud case in Virginia. Someone may have been using one of the senator's cards at a social club out in Culpeper. Yarrow was very good. He didn't even flinch when I referred to the club at Blacksmith Farms.
Well, as long as it's quick, he said, just reluctantly enough. Grace, tell Senator Morehouse not to start without me. You can all go ahead. I'm fine with the detective. I'll be right along. It's okay, Grace.
A few seconds later, the senator and I were alone, as much as you could be in a place like this. For all I knew, the three-story coffered dome over our heads carried sound everywhere and anywhere.
So which credit card are we talking about? He asked, with a perfectly straight face.
I kept my voice low. Senator, I'd like to ask you about the $500,000 transfers you've made to a certain overseas account in the past 6 months. Would you rather talk about this somewhere else?
You know what? He said, as brightly as if he were being interviewed by Matt Lauer on the Today Show. I just remembered a file I need for this meeting, and I already sent my aides on. Would you mind walking with me?
Chapter 70. The first thing I noticed about Marshall Yarrow's private office was how many pictures of himself he had mounted on the walls. There seemed to be a visual clique of important people he wanted to be seen with. There was one with the president and one with the vice president. Tiger Woods, Bono, Arnold and Maria, Bob Woodward, Robert Barnett. He was obviously a well-connected man, and he wanted everyone who walked into his office to know it right away. Yarrow perched on the edge of a huge cherry-inlaid desk and made a point of not asking me to sit down. I'd known I was going to have to be aggressive at first, but now I wanted to back off and see what I could accomplish with a little tact. If Yarrow chose to put up a firewall, it would be hard to get around without subpoenas. Senator, let me start by taking any association you may have with that social club off the table. It's not why I'm here, I told him. That wasn't entirely true, but it was good enough for the time being.
I never said I was associated with any club, he said.
It was a balls of steel moment on his part, especially considering the sex acts I'd seen him performing on more than one of Nicholson's tapes. I didn't push it. Fair enough, but you should know that my focus here is extortion, not solicitation.
Please don't push your way in here doling out some puzzle pieces and holding on to others, Detective, Yarrow said, suddenly more aggressive. I'm too smart and too busy a man for that. What exactly are you hoping to walk away with here?
Good question, and I have an answer. I want you to tell me that those bank transfers are exactly what I think they are. There was a long standoff. I guess he was waiting for me to blink. Then he finally said,
Yeah, okay, let's get this out on the table. I've been on Blacksmith Farms, but for entertainment purposes only. And I don't mean myself. We're talking about out-of-town guests, contributors, visitors from the Middle East, that sort of thing. It's a part of the job, unfortunately. I get them in, have a drink or two, and then leave them to it. That's it. Believe me.
He held up his left hand and waggled a gold-banded finger.
I can no sooner afford to piss Barbara off than I can my whole constituency. There's been no solicitation here. Nothing to be blackmailed for. Am I clear on that?
I started to get real sick of people pretending that none of this was happening. I'm sorry, Senator, but I have evidence to the contrary. Digital video evidence. You sure this is the way you want to go? Senator Yarrow never missed a beat. And he even remembered to pick up the file he supposedly forgotten in the office.
You know, Detective, my caucus meeting started 5 minutes ago, and if I don't get this important water bill moving today, it's not going anywhere. Assuming there aren't any charges here, you're going to have to excuse me.
How long is your meeting? I asked. He flipped a card from his pocket and held it out between two fingers for me.
Give Grace a call. We'll get you on the schedule, he said. I could feel the firewall starting to rise, higher and higher, faster and faster.
Chapter 71. I brought some music to Nana's room that night, a mixed artist CD, the best of U Street, with a lot of big names from when she went to the clubs there with my grandfather and friends. Basie, Sarah Vaughan, Lena Horne, and Sir Duke himself, the great Mr. Ellington. I let it play quietly on Bree's laptop while we visited. The jazz singers weren't the only familiar voices in the room. I'd also brought along Janny and Ali. This was the first night the nurses had allowed Ali into the room. He was so quiet and respectful sitting next to Nana's bed. Such a good little boy.
"What's this for, Dada?"
he asked in the younger-sounding voice he used when he was a little nervous and unsure of himself. "That's the heart monitor. You see those lines? They show Nana's heartbeat. You can see that it's steady right now."
"What about that tube there?"
"That's how Nana gets food while she's in the coma." Then suddenly he said,
"I wish Nana was coming home soon. I wish it more than anything. I say prayers for Nana all day long."
"You can tell her yourself, Ali. Nana's right here. Go ahead if you want to say something."
"She can hear me?"
"She probably can. I think so." I put his hand on Nana's and my hand on top of his. "Go ahead."
"Hi, Nana,"
he said as if Nana were hard of hearing, and it was difficult not to laugh.
"Inside the house voice, buddy," Bree said. "But good enthusiasm there. I'll bet Nana heard you."
Chapter 72. Janny was more reserved with her grandma. She moved kind of awkwardly around the room, like she just wasn't sure how to be herself. Mostly, she hung back by the door until I motioned her over. "Come here, Janelle. I want to show you and Ali something interesting." Ali hung on my arm, and Janny came to look over my shoulder. It was tight in the little space next to the bed, but I liked us pressed in that way. A unit, hopefully ready for whatever came our way. I took a picture out of my wallet. It was the one I'd found in Caroline's apartment, and I'd been carrying it with me. "Now, this is Nana Mama, your Uncle Blake, and me. Way back in 1976, if you can believe it."
"Daddy, you look ridiculous,"
Janny said, pointing at the red, white, and blue hat jammed onto my 70s afro.
"What are you wearing?"
"It's called a boater. It was the bicentennial, America's 200th birthday, and about 1 million people were wearing them that day. Very few looked so jaunty, though."
"Oh, that's really too bad."
Janny sounded somewhere between embarrassed and filled with pity for her poor, clueless father. "Anyway," I went on, "about 5 minutes after this picture was taken, a big Washington Redskins float came by in the parade. They were throwing out mini footballs, and Blake and I just about lost our minds trying to catch one. We ran after the float for blocks without even a second thought for poor Nana Mama. So you know what happened next, right?"
This was mostly for the kids, but also for Nana, like we were sitting around the kitchen table, and she was over at the stove, eavesdropping.
I could just imagine her standing there, stirring something good and pretending not to listen in, getting a wisecrack ready for me. "It took her hours to find us, and let me tell you, when she did, you have never seen Nana that mad in all your life. Not even close." Ali stared at Nana, trying to imagine it.
"How mad was she? Tell me."
"Well, do you remember when she quit us and moved out for a while?"
"Yeah."
"Madder than that, even. And remember when a certain someone," I poked Ali in the ribs, "drove the vacuum cleaner down the stairs and put scratches all over the wood?" He played along and dropped his jaw wide open.
"Madder than that?"
10 times madder, little man."
"What happened, Daddy?"
Janny chimed in. "The truth was, Nana had slapped both of us across the face before she hugged us silly and then brought us a couple of red, white, and blue cotton candies as big as our haircuts on the way home. She'd always been a little old school that way, at least back then. Not that I ever held the occasional whooping against her. That's just the way it was back then. Tough love. But it seemed to work on me. I picked up her hand and looked at her, so frail and still in the bed, like some kind of place marker for the woman I'd known for so long and loved so dearly, possibly since before I could remember. You made sure we never ran off like that again, didn't you, Regina? 2 seconds ago, I'd been making jokes. Now I was feeling overwhelmed, and if I had to guess, I'd say I was feeling a lot of the same emotions Nana had that day on the mall before she found Blake and me, safe and sound. I was scared, and I was desperate, most likely because I was exhausted from fighting back all the worst-case scenarios in my head. More than anything, I wanted our family to be back together, the way it was supposed to be, the way it had always been. But I doubted it was going to happen, and I couldn't really face that yet, or maybe ever. Stay with us, Nana. Chapter 73. The next morning started early. Too early for most of the other detectives on the case. I had a list of names from the diaries in Nicholson's safe deposit box, and Sampson had confirmed current addresses for 22 escorts who'd worked the club in Virginia at one time or another. Starting at 8, I sent out 5 teams of 2 uniformed officers each to pull in as many from the list of escorts as we could find. Presumably, these were nightbirds we were going after. First thing in the morning seemed like a good bet. I wanted to talk to as many of them as possible before any crosstalk could start mucking things up and making this investigation even trickier than it was already. Sampson also called in a favor from our friend Marianne Pantano in the Prostitution Enforcement Unit. She arranged for us to use the office they shared with Narcotics on 3rd Street, and Marianne would also be sitting in for at least some of the interviews. I wanted a white female face on our side of the table to go against the mostly white female prostitutes. By 10 o'clock, we had an impressive 15 of the 22 names accounted for. I spread them out into every conference room, interview space, cubicle, and hallway available, and I don't think I made any new friends in Narcotics that morning. Too bad. I didn't much care that I might be inconveniencing somebody. The place was a total zoo, including the 4 extra officers I kept around to make sure nobody walked out on us. The rest of the team I sent back out to look for the escorts who hadn't turned up. The possibility that some of them might never be found was something I'd have to worry about later. The interviews started slowly. None of these very pretty women trusted us, and I couldn't blame them much for that. We didn't hold back on details of Caroline's murder or the possibility of others. I wanted the young women to realize the kind of danger they'd been in, working for Nicholson, working for anyone in the escort business, anything to get them to talk to us. A few of the women quickly admitted to recognizing Caroline's picture. She'd gone by the name Nicole when she was at the club, which wasn't often from the sound of it. She was nice. She was quiet. In other words, they told me nothing I could use to find her murderer. Instead of lunch, I took a walk around the block to clear my head, but it didn't help much. Was I wasting my time here? Were we asking the wrong questions? Or should we just let the escorts go and try to salvage the afternoon for something else? This was the classic problem for me. I never knew when to stop, because stopping always felt like quitting, and I wasn't ready for that yet. For one thing, I still vividly remember Caroline's remains. I feared there were several others who died the same horrible way. I was on my way back up 3rd Street, feeling no better than before, when my phone rang. Marianne Pantano's name was on the ID. "I'm outside," I answered, trying to clear my head, if that's possible, taking a walk. "Only place I didn't look," she said. "You should get back in here and talk to this girl Lauren again." I started walking faster. "Red hair, shearling coat?" "That's the one, Alex. Seemed like her memory's warming up. She's got a few interesting things to say about one of the missing girls. Catherine Tenencore." Chapter 74. Just like every other escort we'd pulled in today, Lauren Inslee was slender, well-endowed, and absolutely gorgeous. She was a former model in New York and Miami, a graduate of Florida State University, an escort for men with a taste for perky cheerleader types. Nicholson obviously had a variety of tastes to satisfy, but his general aesthetic was expensive.
"Catherine's dead, isn't she?"
That was the first thing Lauren asked when I sat down with her.
"Nobody will tell me anything. You want us to talk, but you people won't say a word about what happened."
"That's because we don't know, Lauren. That's why we're talking to you."
"Okay, but what do you think? I don't want to be morbid, I just want to know. She was a friend of mine, another Florida girl. She was going to be a lawyer. She'd been accepted at Stetson, which is a really good school."
Lauren played with a paper napkin the whole time she spoke, tearing it into tiny pieces. A slice of the pizza we'd brought in sat untouched on a plate next to the torn shreds of napkin. I believed that all she wanted to hear was the truth, so I decided to give it to her. "The police report says there's no indication that she packed a bag at her apartment. Given the amount of time it's been, yes, there's a good chance she's not coming back."
"Oh, God."
The girl turned away, fighting tears, hugging herself tightly. It was getting more depressing in here by the second. We were in one of the larger interview rooms, with graffiti burning right through the latest paint job on the walls and scorch marks on the floor from years of cigarette butts. "Detective Pontano says that you mentioned something about a specific client at Blacksmith, and maybe Catherine. Lauren, tell me about the client."
"I don't know," she said. "Maybe. I mean, I know what Catherine told me, but that place was all rumors all the time."
I kept my voice even and as calming as possible.
"What did she tell you, Lauren?
We're not going to arrest you for anything you say in here. You can believe me on that. This is a big homicide case. I don't give a damn about Vice."
"She said she had a private scheduled with someone, a big hitter she called Zeus. That was the last time I ever talked to Catherine."
I wrote it down. "Zeus? Is that some kind of alias? Or was it Catherine's code for the client?" She dabbed at her eyes.
"An alias. Almost everyone uses booking names. You know, Mr. Shakespeare, Pigskin, Dirty Harry, whatever strikes their fancy. It's not like you don't end up face to face, but it does mean nobody's real name gets written down anywhere. Believe me, it's safer for everybody that way."
"Sure it is," I nodded. "So, Lauren, do you know who Zeus is? Any idea?"
"I don't know, honestly. This is what I'm saying, trying to say. Supposedly he had something to do with the government, but Catherine could be gullible that way. I didn't even think twice about it when she told me."
My mind was racing ahead a little now.
"Gullible how? Can you expand on that for me? What do you mean?"
Lauren sat back and pushed both hands through her hair, away from her face. I think finally talking about Catherine was a relief for her, if not for me.
"This is the thing you need to understand," she said, and leaned in closer. "Clients lie about what they do all the time. Like, if you think they're more important than they really are, you'll work harder, or let them go bareback, or whatever crazy shit it is they're fantasizing about. So I never believe half of what I hear. In fact, I just assume that the ones who talk about their lives are lying. The men with the real power, those are the ones who keep it all to themselves."
"And Zeus?"
"Honestly, I don't even know if he exists. It's just a name. The name of a Greek god, right?"
"Greek?
Maybe that's a clue. His sexual preference?"
Chapter 75. I never got to make up my own mind about what I thought of Lauren's story, because the next morning, it was made up for me. I was gassing up my rental at 7-Eleven on L Street near home, mostly thinking about how I missed my own car. It was in the shop for new glass after the shootout in Alexandria, and I wanted it back yesterday. There's just no substitute for familiarity, the old faithful comfort zone, even the cup holder in just that spot where you automatically reach. When the cell phone rang, it was a blocked number, but I'd been answering everything since Nana went into the hospital. I didn't even think about it.
Dr. Cross?
It was a woman's voice, a little formal, no one I knew. Please hold for the White House Chief of Staff. Before I could respond, I was put on hold. I was stunned, not just by the call itself, but by the timing. What the hell was going on here? What now? The White House was calling? Could this be for real? It didn't take long for Gabriel Reese to come on the line. I recognized his distinctive voice right away, probably from seeing him on the news and the occasional Sunday morning show like Meet the Press.
Hello, Detective Cross. How are you today?
He began in a chipper enough tone. I guess that depends, Mr. Reese. May I ask, how did you get my number? He didn't answer, of course.
I'd like to meet with you as soon as possible. Here in my office would be best. It's all been cleared up the line. How soon could you be available?
I thought about Ned Mahoney and how agitated he had been the other day, how paranoid he had seemed about the records from the investigation getting out. Well, I guess they were out.
Excuse me, Mr. Reese, but what is this about? Can I at least ask that?
There was a pause on the line, carefully chosen, maybe. I wasn't sure. Then Reese said,
I think you already know.
Well, I did now. I can be there in about 15 minutes, I said. Then Reese surprised me again.
No, tell me where you are. We'll pick you up.
Chapter 76. A livery car with a military driver got to my location within a few minutes. The driver followed me to a nearby parking garage, waited, and then took me to the White House. We came in at the Northwest Appointment Gate, off Pennsylvania. I had to show my ID twice, to the sentry at the gate, and then to the armed guard who greeted me at the West Wing turnaround. From there, a Secret Service agent walked me straight in through the entrance closest to the Rose Garden. I'd been to the White House enough times to know that I was on a fast track, leading straight to the Chief of Staff's office. I also understood that they didn't want my visit to attract attention, the reason for the escort. Gabriel Reese had a reputation as a wonk more than a bulldog, but also for the kind of covert power he wielded here. He and President Vance went back years. More than a few pundits had labeled him the de facto vice president of the administration. What that meant to me was Reese had either initiated this meeting on his own or at the president's request. I didn't think I liked either possibility. My Secret Service escort delivered me to a woman whose voice matched the one from before on the phone. She offered me coffee, which I declined, and then walked me right in to meet Gabriel Reese.
Detective Cross, thank you for coming.
He shook my hand across the desk and motioned for me to sit in one of the tall wing chairs.
I'm so sorry about your niece. It must have been a horrible shock. I can't even imagine.
It was, thank you, I said. But I have to tell you, I'm a little uneasy with the amount of information you have about this case. He looked surprised.
It would be much stranger if I didn't. Anything to do with the White House is the Secret Service's job to know.
I tried to cover my surprise. What did my murder investigation have to do with the White House? What was going on? In that case, I would have thought I'd be meeting with them, I said. The Secret Service.
One thing at a time, he said.
Fine. That was about all my nervous system could handle anyway. There was nothing aggressive about Reese's manner. He just seemed very sure of himself. Actually, he seemed younger in person, even a little preppy looking, with a button-down collar and conservative tie. You'd never know to see him that his thumbprint was on American policy all over the world.
For now, he went on,
I'd like to hear about how the investigation is coming along. Bring me up to speed about the way you see things, what you found out so far.
This interview was getting stranger by the minute.
It's coming along fine, thanks.
I think I know what you meant. With all due respect, though, Mr. Reese, I don't report to the White House. Not yet, anyway, I thought.
I see. Of course, you're right. You're absolutely right. My apologies for overreacting.
I'd already gone further than I meant to, but so had Reese. I decided to stay on the offensive with him. Have you ever heard the name Zeus in connection with any of this? I asked. He considered the question for a second.
Not that I can recall. And I think I would. A name like Zeus.
I was pretty sure he was lying, and it reminded me of something Lauren Inslee had said about her clients. Why would someone like Reese even answer my question, except to lie? When the phone on his desk buzzed, he picked it up right away. He watched me while he listened, then stood as soon as he hung up.
Would you excuse me for a minute? I'm sorry about this. I know how busy you are.
As he walked out of the room, a Secret Service agent stepped into the open doorway with his back to me. I couldn't help wondering what would happen if I tried to leave. Instead, I just sat there and attempted to get my bearings. Why was the White House chief of staff involved with my case? How? Soon enough, there were voices outside, just a low murmur that I couldn't understand from where I was sitting. The agent in the door stepped out and another one took his place. He came in and glanced quickly around the office. His eyes played right over me the way they did the rest of the furniture. Then he moved aside to make way for the president, who walked into the room smiling.
Alex Cross, I've heard so much about you. All of it good, she said.
Chapter 77. The president's vibe was completely different from Reese's. She was almost collegial the way she shook my hand and settled onto the tufted leather couch instead of behind the desk. Not that it did anything to put me at ease.
I read your book, she told me. Years ago, but I remember it well. Very interesting stuff, and so very scary because it's all true.
Thank you, Madam President. I admired Margaret Vance. She'd done a lot to get both sides of the aisle talking to each other. She and her husband, Theodore Vance, were both powerful figures, not only in Washington, but around the world. All things being equal, I would have liked to work with the president. But things were definitely not equal right now.
I'd like to ask you a favor, Dr. Cross.
She nodded at her agent to leave us alone, and I waited for him to close the door. Regarding my investigation?
That's right. I think you'll agree it's important this case not proceed in a way that could threaten innocent people, or especially national security, or even the everyday workings of our government. Allegations can be just as harmful as indictments if they're brought to light in the wrong way. You know that, of course.
Yes, I agreed. I have a bit of experience with that.
So you can appreciate the delicacy here.
She was talking more at me than to me, and seemed to think this was all already settled.
I'd like you to meet with one of our lead agents, Dan Cormorant. Get him up to speed and transition the case into his care.
I'm not sure I'm in a position to do that, I told her, for several reasons.
It won't be a problem. The Services Uniform Division has all the statutory authority of the Metropolitan Police.
I nodded. Within the city limits, that's true. It was like I wasn't even speaking anymore, the way she went on.
And of course, all the field resources any investigation could possibly need. We've got the best in the world working for us here.
She stopped and looked at me over the top of her glasses.
Present company excluded, of course.
My, my, my. It's a truly original feeling to have your ass kissed by the leader of the free world. Too bad I couldn't enjoy it for more than a few seconds. I've got a pretty good internal compass, but for all I knew, it was sending me right over an edge I'd never come back from. "President Vance," I said. My heart might have been thudding, but my mind was still clear. "I'd like to take all of this under advisement and respond sometime in the next 24 hours, either in writing or in person, whichever you prefer." She didn't try to hide how she felt about that. Two lines showed up around her mouth like parentheses. "I'm not here to negotiate, Dr. Cross. This meeting is a courtesy and an extraordinary one at that. I assumed someone like you preferred not to be walked over. That was obviously my mistake." She stood up and I followed suit. "Frankly, I'm surprised. I've been told you were a bright man and a patriot." "A patriot in a very difficult position right now, Madam President." Vance didn't address me after that. The last thing I heard her say was to the agent on the other side of the door as she left.
"Show Dr. Cross out. We're done here."
Part 4. Burning Down the House. Chapter 78.
The murder mystery was turning out to be more like a plague, spreading and infecting anyone who touched it, killing them. Adam Potoski sat up suddenly on the couch, all 5'4" of him. His heart was kicking at the inside of his chest. Something besides a terrifying nightmare had just woken him, though there had been plenty of those lately, too. What was it? What now? His apartment was dark except for the TV. He'd been watching The Daily Show when he dropped off, finding solace in the droll humor of Jon Stewart. Now there was an infomercial on, people laughing and screaming about some weight loss thing. Maybe that's what woke him. Paranoia was his roommate these days, and one hairy bitch to be cooped up with, too. He hadn't left the apartment in a week. Literally, a week. The phones were unplugged, the shades were drawn at all times, and garbage was piling up by the back door, ever since he'd nailed it shut on that first night when he couldn't sleep a wink. There were things Adam Potoski knew, things he wished to hell he didn't know. Working for Tony Nicholson and his girlfriend Mara, cooking the books and looking the other way had been shitty enough. Not working for him, not hearing a word from him, as it turned out, was even worse. Like tonight, just to use a handy example, he stood up off the couch, still a little shaky. Halfway to the kitchen, he stopped. For the 100th time that week, he felt almost sure someone was behind him. And then, before he could even turn around, someone was. A strong arm looped across his throat and pulled hard until his feet nearly left the floor. Duct tape was pressed over his mouth. He heard it rip in the back and felt it stick and tighten. "Don't fight, Mr. Potoski. You fight, you lose. You die." A hard finger pressed into the spot between his shoulder blades and moved him toward the bedroom door. "Let's go. This way, my friend." Potoski's brain squirmed. He was a numbers man, after all. He could run equations and probabilities like a machine, and right now, everything he knew told him to do as this guy said. It was even a strange kind of relief, following someone's orders after 7 days of solitude in this hellhole. In the bedroom, the man turned on a light. He was no one Potoski recognized, tall and white with gray-flecked dark hair. His gun had one of those extensions on it, a silencer, if the ones on TV were any indication. "Pack a bag," he said. "Don't leave anything out. Clothes, wallet, passport, whatever you need for a long trip." Potoski didn't hesitate, but a whole new raft of questions floated into his crowded mind as he started to pack. Where was he going? What kind of long trip? And how could he possibly convince anyone of the truth that he'd never had any intention of telling a soul what he knew? "One thing at a time, Potoski. Clothes, wallet, passport. Now, get in the bathroom," the man told him. "Pack everything you'll need in there." Right, he thought, clinging to the task at hand. Don't leave anything out. Toothbrush, toothpaste, shaver, condoms. Sure. Why not be positive? The master bath was tiny, with barely enough room to stand between the pedestal sink, toilet, and shower. Potoski opened the medicine cabinet, but then he felt another poke between his shoulder blades. Get in the tub and lie down, little man. It made no sense, but nothing did right now. Was he going to be tied up in the tub? Robbed? Left behind, after all? No, the man said. The other way, with your head down by the drain. And suddenly it all became horribly clear. For the first time, Petoskey screamed, and he heard just how tiny his voice was from behind the tape. This was it. This was really it. Tonight, he disappeared forever. He knew too much. The famous names. All their dirty secrets.
Chapter 79. I had fewer and fewer people I could talk to about this murder case anymore. Lucky for me, Nana was still one of them. For a few days, I'd been holding back on her. Somehow it seemed wrong to bring the extra stress into her room at the hospital. But as the days had passed and these visits of mine turned into their own kind of normal, I started to realize something. If Nana were awake through all of this, she would have been asking about Caroline's case every day. No doubt about it in my mind. So I didn't hold back anymore. It's not going well, old woman. Caroline's murder case, I told her that night. I'm overwhelmed, to be honest. I've never been in a position like this before. Not that I can remember, anyway. Ramon Davies is ready to take me off. The Bureau is going at it full clip, and now I don't even know where they are on it. I've got the White House breathing down my neck, if you can believe that. Believe it. And these are supposed to be the good guys, Nana. I don't know. It's getting harder and harder to tell the difference anymore. It's like somebody said, you can love this country and hate our government. It was quiet in the room as usual. I kept the heart monitor volume down when I was there, so the only sounds beside my own voice were the hiss of the ventilator and an occasional snatch of conversation from the nurse's station down the hall. Nana's condition hadn't changed, but she just seemed sicker to me. Smaller, grayer, more distant. It felt as though everything in my life was sliding in the same direction these days. I don't know where to go with any of this. One way or another, it's going to come out, and it's going to be huge when it does. I mean like Watergate huge, old woman. There'll be hearings and spin, and probably no one's ever going to know the real story. But I feel like I'm the only one who even wants to open that particular door. I want to know. I need to know. There was one other thing about the quiet. It meant that I could hear Nana talking back.
Poor Alex. An army of one, huh? What else have you got?
It wasn't a rhetorical question. She'd really want to know. So I gave it some thought. I had Samson on my side. I had Bree, of course. I had Ned Mahoney, somewhere out there. And I had one other rainy day idea I'd been sitting on. It wasn't the kind of thing that could be undone once it was started, but hey, how much rainier did I expect it to get? I reached through the bed rail and put my hands on Nana's. Things like touch had become more important than ever to me. Any way I could connect with her, for as long as I could. The room's ventilator hissed. Someone laughed down the hall. Thank you, old woman, I said, wherever you are.
You're welcome,
she communicated somehow, and we left it at that. As always, Nana had the last word.
Chapter 80.
And people continued to die. Anyone who knew anything was at risk. It was 2,000 miles from Virginia back to the island of Trinidad, and the bright blue house where Esther Walcott had grown up, just outside the capital city of Port of Spain. That's where she'd run to after the raid on Mr. Nicholson's club. Mom and Bap had welcomed her home with open arms and, more important, asked no questions about the life she'd left behind so abruptly in America. 2 years of hostessing and recruiting for the club in Virginia had left her with a nice bank account, if nothing else, and she planned on putting it toward a hair and nail boutique of her own, maybe even something at West Mall like she'd always imagined as a girl. It seemed like the perfect way to start her life over. But when she woke up on that third night home with a man's hand pressed tightly over her mouth and heard the American accent in her ear, Esther knew that she hadn't run far enough. "One peep, and I'll kill everyone in the house. Everyone. Do you understand what I'm saying, Esther? Just nod." It was almost impossible not to scream. Her breath was coming in fast, high-pitched gasps, but she managed to nod yes. "Good girl. Smart girl. Just like at the club in America. Where's your suitcase?" She pointed to the closet. "Okay, very slowly now. I want you to sit up." He got her propped up in bed and pasted a length of tape over her mouth before he let go. It was 75 degrees out, but she was shaking as if it were 30. The touch of his rough hands on her stomach and breasts made her feel practically naked and vulnerable and sad. When a light showed under her door, Esther's heart flip-flopped, a rush of hope at first, but then dread. Someone was coming. The intruder turned to her in the semi-dark and held a finger to his lips, reminding her of what was at stake, her family. A moment later, there was a soft knock. "Esther." It was her mother's voice, and all at once, more than she could take, her right hand flew up and clawed the tape off her mouth.
"Run, Mommy! Man has a gun! Run!"
Instead, the door to the bedroom flew open. For a moment, Esther saw the wide shape of her mother shadowed against the light from the hall. There was a soft popping sound, nothing like a regular gunshot, but Miranda Walcott clutched her chest and collapsed to the floor without another word. Now Esther was screaming, and couldn't have stopped if she'd wanted to. Next, she heard her father's voice coming closer. He was running. "Esther? Miranda?" he called out. The intruder left her side, heading for the door, and she threw herself after him, if only to catch his ankles, make him fall somehow. Instead, she hit the floor hard and again heard the awful popping sound. Something shattered in the hall, and her poor Bap crashed against the wall. Sparks of white light played at the edges of Esther's vision, and the room swam even as she scrambled up onto the bed again. With both fists, she pushed and clawed through the screen mesh in the window. It wasn't far to a patch of black sage bushes below, and she was more outside than in when strong hands latched onto her ankles and started to pull. Her body scraped hard over the wooden sill as she reversed direction. One more time, Esther screamed, knowing that the neighbors would hear, but also that it was too late to matter. They were going to kill everyone who knew anything and anyone else in the way.
Chapter 81. Damon had come home for the weekend, which was a great thing for everybody. I'd bought him a ticket and asked him to make the trip, partly because of Nana, partly because all of this upset was making us miss him more than ever. Anyway, I wanted the kids together in one place, even if it was only for a couple days. We started with a welcome home dinner for Day, including a lot of his favorites. Caesar salad for everyone, with anchovies for me. Nana's sloppy joes and sourdough bowls that the younger two had hollowed out, and Janny's monkey bread for dessert. It was the first time she'd ever made the bread by herself, without Nana's help. Everything about Dave's visit was happy and sad at the same time. It was interesting to see the changes around the house through Damon's eyes. Janny, Ali, and I had gotten used to Bree coordinating schedules, helping with homework, and putting meals on the table. For Damon, though, it was all new. Mostly, he didn't comment other than a lot of thank yous, which were much appreciated by Bree. I waited until we'd heard about life at Cushing Academy and had enjoyed our meal together before I steered the conversation around to Nana Mama. "Let's talk about it," I finally said. Janny gave a sigh. She was the one who kept the most informed, but emotionally, I think this was harder for her than anyone. She and Nana were incredibly close. They did everything together, and had since Janny was a baby.
"What do you mean, Dad?" Damon asked. "We all know what's going on, don't we?"
Just what I said. We should talk. Nana could get better soon. That's what we're hoping for. Or she could be in a coma for a while. It's also possible that she won't wake up again.
She could die,
Jenny said a little rudely.
We get it, Dad. Even Ali does.
I looked over at Ali, but he seemed all right so far. In his way, he was older than his age. Both Nana and I had talked to him like an adult, respected his intelligence since he was around 4 years old. One of my theories, and Nana's, about raising kids is that you cannot give them too much love, but that the environment inside your house has to bear a relationship to what they will face on the outside. So no excess coddling or making excuses for unacceptable behavior. I nodded Janelle's way. We all get it. We're all sad, and we're angry. Come here, everybody. Maybe I'm the only one who needs a little help right now. We gathered close for a group hug, and it was better that way, thinking about Nana without speaking. Bree was the first to break down, and then everybody was in tears. No shame in that. Nothing but love on display. That may not work for all families, but it sure does for us. Chapter 82. By Monday, I was ready to make my next move on the case. Her name was Wiley Reckler, although her readers knew her simply as Jenna. She'd been helpful to the FBI and Metro before. In particular, she had aided Vice. Wiley Reckler was DC's answer to Cindy Adams and Perez Hilton, with a hugely popular gossip blog called Jenna Knows. She'd used it to break a couple of smaller Washington stories over the years. Angelina Jolie's nomination to the Council on Foreign Relations, Barack Obama's closet cigarette habit. But most of her space was dedicated to the social and sex lives of the people who matter most, as her homepage called them. Samson and I caught up with the popular gossipist that afternoon at the Neiman Marcus store in Friendship Heights. Wiley was launching a new designer scent, whatever that means, also called Jenna Knows. With the smell of cheap perfume as thick in the air as it was, I kept thinking of it as Jenna Knows, N-O-S-E, instead. She was set up in the middle of the store near the escalators. Pretty ladies in black smocks were spritzing passersby, while Jenna herself autographed bottles from a big pyramid of red and black boxes on a C-shaped counter. When she saw our detective badges, she put a perfectly manicured hand up to her chest. Oh my God, I've finally gone too far, haven't I? It got a good laugh from the crowd behind us. I was wondering if I could persuade you to take five, I asked her. It's important. May we? Wiley stood up with a little flourish. Excuse me, ladies, but gossip awaits. The Metro Police know all, but will they tell all? Some of the theatricality dropped off as soon as we were away from the crowd. I'm not actually in any trouble here, am I? She asked. Nothing like that, Samson said, and held the door for her out to Wisconsin Avenue. We just need some help. We waited until we were in my car to go on. Then I asked her point blank. I'm wondering if you've heard anything about a sex club for heavy hitters. Out in Virginia? Place called Blacksmith Farms? We're looking, first of all, for some verification. She'd been rustling inside a little red clutch purse, but now she stopped cold. You mean it's true? I'm just wondering what you've heard. Names, stories, anything at all? Nothing in a while, she said, pulling out a lipstick. Not enough to make a story I could go with. I figured it was, what, a ridiculous suburban myth?
Aren't you in the business of publishing rumors? Samson asked her.
Honey, I'm in the business of being as accurate as I can be and not getting my ass sued. I learned that the hard way blogging on Condi Rice's love life. And just for the record, there's no such thing as an old rumor in Washington.
How do you mean that? I asked.
I mean you can't swing a stick around here without hitting some investigative reporter looking to make a name for themselves. Rumors either turn into headlines real quick or they're dead on arrival. When I didn't hear any more about that one, I figured it was a dead end.
She smiled happily and started reddening her lips in the rearview mirror.
Until now, anyway.
That's another thing, I said, catching her eye. I need you to sit on this for a while.
Excuse me? You do know what I do for a living, don't you?
And I assume you know what I do, I said. This is a murder investigation, Jenna, not a game. Do you understand what I'm saying here?
Okay, now you're scaring me, she said, returning the lipstick to her purse.
Then she finally opened up and gave me a few names she'd heard connected to the sex club, new names, which was helpful. Listen, I handed her two of my business cards. Call me if you hear anything else, and please give me your number too. As soon as this thing is ready to go, I'll bring you whatever I have. Do we have a deal?